Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the North Carolina Legislature in downtown Raleigh, it is Thursday, October 19th, 2017. Glad to have you along for this edition of the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Another push for health care policy, controversy surrounding Gold Star families, and infuriated Democrats. Those are just some of the stories out of Washington this week. Joining us on the line from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue to help us, hopefully, better digest all this is NPR White House reporter Jeff Bennett. Hi there, Jeff.
Hey, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing well. Glad to have you here. The seemingly never-ending discussion about replacing the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, continued this week with a bipartisan proposal from U.S. Senators Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray. That's a Republican and a Democrat. Perhaps some progress here. The effort would restore cost-sharing payments to health insurers. That's a provision that the president had eliminated last week. Is this proposal any more viable than the others that have failed in recent months?
Yeah, it's not viable if the president doesn't come out and support it, because the Republicans, both in the House and in the Senate, more to the point in the Senate, wouldn't have enough political cover to vote for it. It seems to me that the president wants Obamacare to fall apart, but he also wants someone else to be blamed for it, namely Congress. And those two goals are in conflict. So, remember on Monday in the Rose Garden, right as news broke of this tentative agreement on the Hill between Murray and Alexander, the president was in the Rose Garden with the Greek prime minister giving a news conference, and he was asked about it. And he credited both of those two lawmakers, one Democrat, one Republican. And he also, in a way, seemed to take credit for it, saying that the White House was aware of what was going on and that he was fully involved. He called it a good short-term solution. Fast forward just a few hours, he gave a speech before the Conservative Heritage Foundation, and he described the bill as being a bailout to insurance companies, even though the language in the bill explicitly prohibits money going directly into the coffers of the insurance companies. I think what's happening here is that conservative Republicans, the far-right activist wing of the party, doesn't want Republican lawmakers to be on the hook to vote for propping up the Affordable Care Act when they've just spent the last 7 years actively advocating against it, saying, pledging it to scrap it, something, by the way, they have not been able to do.
I'm sorry to laugh. It seems like rock in a hard place is an understatement. Well, are there elements of this proposal that do shine light or give optimism for those who are trying to reach this finish line, so to speak? Are there any signs that they're a little bit closer, that they've reached consensus on particular areas of the Affordable Care Act?
I think so. I mean, I think on the larger issue, lawmakers, Democrat and Republican, both realize, whether they say it publicly or not, that they have to do something in the short term to prop up the exchanges until they have some sort of longer-term solution. So Lamar Alexander, the Republican sponsor of the bill, told our team on the Hill yesterday that he believes the pushback from the president to be part of the overall legislative process. And both sides, actually, are finding co-sponsors, because what they want to do is they want to have a mix of Democrats and Republicans who represent a range of ideologies in both parties to show that this is a true bipartisan approach. So you have folks like Bob Corker, John McCain, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, some of those people, by the way, who opposed the last Republican-led
right.
Obamacare repeal effort, who would support the Alexander-Murray bill. Problem, of course, is that they need to get to 60 votes, and it would probably be some mix of Democrats and Republicans voting for that. It would not be, the all Republican approach that the GOP sought to undo the Affordable Care Act. But still, if without the president giving his full-throated support for this thing, there will not be enough Republican votes for it.
All right. So it seems as though, from what you're saying, what I've read and seen this week, that this is a path back toward the middle to some extent. I mean, this is more of a moderate middle-of-the-road approach with lawmakers from both sides. Do we have any sense of where the president will go next with this particular piece of news out of Washington?
Not really. I mean, there's still some talk about the Graham Cassidy approach. But I think the thing is, until leaders in the House and the Senate have a chance to check in with their members, see what they're comfortable with voting for, we're really just at an impasse. And you have, you know, and over in the House anyway, Speaker Paul Ryan saying that he wouldn't bring any sort of market stabilization bill to the floor. He wasn't speaking specifically of the Alexander Murray bill, but he was just saying generally he wouldn't bring any bill to the floor that would prop up the exchanges. So, again, until the president makes clear what he wants to do and sticks to a position, there really isn't going to be any movement on this. This is why you have folks like Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, yesterday telling reporters that he views the president as being, as he put it, the obstructionist in chief. Because, you know, especially when it comes to health care and then even the program to replace DACA, the program that would or that did protect roughly 800,000 young people brought to the country illegally as children. Remember, a few months ago, Democrats left a meeting with the president believing that they had an agreement in principle that the president would support the DREAM Act in exchange for some modest border security measures. Fast forward a couple of weeks, the president then met with Republicans, and then he apparently backed their more restrictive approach. So, you know, Democrats are frustrated. Some are infuriated by what they perceive as the president's flip-flopping on these issues when presidential leadership is crucial to this.
I understand this is an ongoing conversation and part of a promise that many, many Republicans have made, a pledge they've made going back years now. But remind us, walk us through the timeline of this, if there even is one. I mean, lawmakers are on Capitol Hill for several more weeks, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. But there's no looming deadline here. I mean, this is bluster is too strong, but this is just kind of the latest moment of this being volleyed back and forth. And yes, it's a different proposal, but we're not facing anything imminent in terms of a deadline, are we?
No imminent deadline. I think the real danger is that the insurance companies who see all this volatility in the market will just continue to raise premiums to cover their costs or their expected costs. So even the things that the president tweets about the Affordable Care Act, and there is so often a disconnect between what he tweets, what he says, and what he actually does, but even the messaging around it is the thing that really throws the markets into disarray. And the Congressional Budget Office, the sort of the nonpartisan bean counters in the federal government, have said that by and large, left untouched, the exchanges would be okay. But the president taking these steps to as Steve Bannon, his former White House chief advisor, put it, to blow up the exchanges, you know, puts a finger on the scale and really changes things. And that's one of the reasons why lawmakers see the urgent need to do something.
All right. So as we, you know, right now we're less than 13 months away from the midterms of 2018. As we get closer to that, what is your sense in terms of the Republican position or viewpoint on, A, we really need to do something. We have to reach some sort of progress, step forward. We have to repeal part of this. We've got to do something, as opposed to, well, shoot, if we cast the wrong kind of vote right now, it could spell even more doom and gloom for us in 2018, using history as a backdrop there. But as we get closer, is it A or B? I mean, is there more of a push to get something done, or do you start to back away from it at some point?
They want to get the Republicans on the Hill want to get something done, but not on health care necessarily. I think most lawmakers that I've talked to, both in private and on the record, really just want to get this health care thing out of their lives, right? And they're more than happy to move on to taxes, where they feel like if they can't pass a tax overhaul, they can at least do something on tax cuts and be able to sell that as they, you know, face voters in the midterm elections. And so we've already seen time and time again the trouble that arises when politicians try to do anything with the Affordable Care Act. And the incentive structure hasn't really changed much for members, so there's not a whole lot. I mean, the Alexander Murray bill, which is really a short-term solution, that's sort of a particular thing, but there isn't a whole lot that has changed since the spectacular collapse of the Republican effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. So they are really moving on to taxes, and you have folks like Senator Lindsey Graham making it clear that if the party can't do anything on taxes, they're going to pay for it in the midterm elections. And so you have folks on the Hill who really want to pivot and make that their primary focus, both substantively but also in terms of the messaging. And the president, who is just not really able to give up this this obsession he has with cutting the Affordable Care Act, scrapping the Affordable Care Act.
All right. I mentioned 13 months from the midterms, but perhaps more importantly or also of note is that primaries are going to begin, what, in 3 or 4 months here in some states across the country, midterm primaries, tea leaves, crystal ball here. Do you think something significant gets done in the next 6 months out of Congress?
I don't think so, apart from what they actually have to do, you know, the basic work of keeping the government funded, that sort of thing. I do think there is a real push around taxes. It's still too early to tell what form that will take. But then you have folks like Steve Bannon, Sebastian Gorka, the president's supporters, who, you know, Bannon obviously was his former chief strategist, who has made very clear his intentions to primary Republican incumbents, save for the Ted Cruz. The Republicans I've talked to on the Hill don't take that all that seriously. But the thing is, they are going to have to focus on primary races where they probably didn't want or have to focus earlier with Bannon, if Bannon makes good on his threat. So there are all sorts of complicating factors that really make the policy work all the more difficult.
Jeff Bennett of NPR is your guest on the WUNC Politics podcast this week. He joins us from the White House, where NPR has its own studio. There's like a bay of editing studios. How does it work there? Where are you?
So I'm actually in the White House basement, not too far from the old White House pool.
Okay.
I mean, like the physical pool that was filled with
water. Swimming pool, yeah.
Because there is also a pool of reporters, as we refer to it. It's a small group of reporters that travels with the president on any given day. So what people probably don't see when they see the briefing room is that behind the seats in the briefing room, there's a small control room area for all the TV networks. And then behind that, there are workspaces. And then there are a set of stairs where downstairs there are, I'd say, about 10 to 15 edit bays. So all of the major broadcasting and print outlets have workspaces in the basement. And then apart from that, the TV stations have an area that you would see on the nightly news, for instance, where you see the White House in the background. And that's called Pebble Beach because it used to actually be physically filled with a bunch of rocks.
Interesting.
And now it's been covered, you know, it's been covered with, they have a, you know, like slate tiles and stuff.
Right.
And it's tented. But back in the day, literally, it was just a gravelly driveway
that's
where
right.
cameramen and reporters would go out to file throughout the day. So that's effectively it. We're pretty much given free rein of these three areas. The briefing room, there's an area where the press staff works where we're able to go, down here in the basement, and then outside, which is on the North Lawn.
Regularly, do you have pinch-me moments? Is it, oh my gosh, I'm going into the White House to go to work? Or at this point, is it you've done it enough and you're just thinking, I got to get to my desk and get to work?
I have a pinch-me moment every morning, actually, when I come through security and then, you know, walk down the driveway. The same driveway, by the way, where the president, not just President Trump, but every president will come out from the West Wing doors to greet foreign leaders. I sort of walk by there as I head into the briefing room. So none of this is lost on me, really, the opportunity to report on the White House and cover the presidency day in and day out. It's a huge privilege.
You are actually moving over and leaving NPR, but I guess I'll drop a little tease within the podcast because I don't want to forget to at least touch on a controversy that bubbled over this week. So we'll get back to the White House in a moment. But before we do, the more serious matter, not to take your career unseriously, but the controversy that came up this week dealt with Gold Star families and presidents. The president criticizing predecessors for not calling the parents of fallen soldiers. It escalated or it turned when a congresswoman accused the president of being insensitive on a call to the widow of a Green Beret. The president pivoted and called that fake news. There was apparently a pledge from the president to provide $25,000 to a Gold Star family, but no check had gone out. When pressed by the Washington Post, the communication staff said that, oh, indeed, a check was in the mail. The latest, like, really? Like, this is what we're going to have a controversy about? One of these things that felt like it was off limits and everyone was in support of. This didn't seem like it was something that was going to elevate to controversy. Tell me, as a journalist, as a reporter, how you have covered this story.
Well, you know, when I took this beat, someone told me that 50% of covering the Trump White House is figuring out where his outrage is directed at any given moment, whether it's internally at his staff or whether it's a sort of a cultural issue. After the whole back and forth around the racial protests in Charlottesville, I thought we'd seen sort of the lows of where this could go politically. But I'll tell you, this past week with this story in particular, it's just really, I mean, I'm almost at a loss for words to describe it. Because apart from this really unfortunate back and forth about how former presidents have handled the families of fallen soldiers, at the end of it, you have these four families who are grieving this very, you know, just unspeakable loss. One family in particular that feels disrespected after their encounter with the president, you know, whether it's something he said or didn't say. And so if the White House wants to defend themselves politically, fine, that's a story unto itself. But I keep coming back to this family, the Johnson family, and how they feel having to mourn the loss of their son, in the case of Maisha Johnson, her husband, in the case of his two children, another child on the way, their father. That grief is very specific. It's personal, and it should be personal. And yet we have this family, for whatever reason, drawn into this really unfortunate and political back and forth. And it really is just, it's beyond sad. So, I mean, you ask how we covered it. You know, we covered it as we would anything else. You know, I was at the briefing yesterday. We got a chance to ask Sarah Huckabee Sanders about it. She made the point that it was, I think she used the phrase disgusting, how it had been politicized. Even though, when the president was asked about this on Monday, he was asked specifically why he hadn't spoken in nearly 2 weeks about the loss of these four Green Berets. And then he pretty much answered a question that wasn't asked. He went directly to this other issue of contacting the families and how he falsely claimed that other presidents hadn't done it. It's sad. There's no other way to describe it. The whole thing, I think, is just really sad.
Sure. One of the ongoing questions for me, and I think for a lot of reporters and folks who just follow politics with this administration and these controversies, thinking about this latest one, the NFL, you know, Confederate monuments, at least in my mind, I think in many others, is just how orchestrated is all of this from the standpoint of the president. And I realize there are 12 different or more opinions on that, and we could probably talk about that for a while. But what's your sense of how orchestrated this really all is?
I don't think his comments about the four servicemen lost in Niger, I don't think that was orchestrated at all. I think that happened in the moment. If anything, I think it shows how dangerous having an extemporaneous governing style can be when there's apparently so little thought given to some of the things that he says before he actually says them. The NFL thing, I think, though, is very different because when you have a president who's polling at, 30, 40% approval rating nationally, to take an issue like the NFL protests, which I haven't looked at the latest numbers, but I'd say it's, 50-50, and his base of supporters agrees with him that people should stand during the national anthem, even though that's not what those players were protesting initially. I do think it's intentional and it's strategic the way that he has time and time again come back to that issue, even with the issue of, you know, Mike Pence going to the Colts game and leaving early, and then the president then saying, well, it was orchestrated in advance, I told him to leave. I do think that's intentional as a way to sort of stoke those flames of the culture war and gin up his base. But for other issues that seem to come out of nowhere and are entirely spontaneous, I don't really see the overarching strategy there, other than the fact that the president does seem to be more focused on some of these cultural issues in a way that he is not focused on specific policy issues.
Jeff Bennett of NPR News is chatting about the latest news out of Washington here on the WNC Politics podcast. Some listeners will remember you from your days with Time Warner Cable, which is now Spectrum down here. You were regularly a face that viewers would see there. You've been on the State of Things. You've been on the podcast before. And you've been with NPR since April-ish, March, April?
Yeah, April, just 4 or 5 months, but maybe 6 months.
And already you've had enough of us and you are moving on. Congratulations. Tell us about a stop with a new post with NBC Nightly News.
Well, I'll be covering the White House for NBC News and MSNBC. So, and I'll also keep a presence on NPR. I'll continue to do the podcast Up First. It's a podcast, but it's also part of Morning Edition.
Okay.
Appearing on some other NPR shows. And if you all would still have me, I'd love to continue doing the podcast in the state of things. I think, frankly, the state of things is how I was sort of brought to the attention of NPR the second go-around. I used to be an editor at NPR for Weekend Edition with Scott Simon, and then years before that, a show that people might remember called News and Notes with Farai Chidea. I worked out of NPR West as an editor and producer on that show.
Very cool. I did not know
that. So, yeah, my roots at NPR run deep, and I'm not moving too far away.
How does your role change at all going back to television? Is it significant? Is it interesting to our listeners in any way, shape, or form?
How will the role change?
Yeah, how will what you're doing change at all?
It's a quicker – the difference between doing TV and the radio, at least the way we do it. I mean, the NPR reporters file for – we call it newscast, but it's what people hear at the top and the bottom of every hour. And so that really takes up the bulk of our day. So quickly metabolizing the news and then turning it into 40-second spots throughout the day. That is beyond what we do for Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I think jumping to a TV platform means that I'll be doing that even more frequently and with less time to think about it.
With less notice, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's like leaving the briefing and then immediately saying, like, you know, tell us what happened. Yeah, what are the major takeaways? So that's the biggest difference, and I think that'll change the way I work the most dramatically. But, you know, all the tenets of journalism are the same. I'll move from the basement to sitting upstairs. The NBC booth is upstairs, so my cell phone reception will improve a little bit.
That's good.
But other than that, you know, the work is by and large is the same.
All right. Well, best of luck in Pebble Beach. Thanks for coming on, and we'll do it again at some point.
Absolutely. Take care, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. As a reminder, you can give us a rating and review on Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, wherever you grab the WUNC Politics podcast. Remember to stay up to date throughout the week with whatever is happening in North Carolina politics at our website, wunc.org. For Jeff, I'm Jeff. Have a great weekend. Talk to you soon.